the most fucked up part about that bill is that the moment you introduce those, you know, centralized human components, the DeFi project is fundamentally at odds with the SEC.
Yep.
Because if you launch a token and you're centralized, you are going to be treated as a security by the SEC. At least at the moment, that's how the SEC thinks about it. So the combination of that bill and the SEC stance towards securities puts all the DeFi projects into an impossible conundrum, right? Like, do you comply with CFTC or do you comply with SEC? Like, it's an impossible problem to solve. It's so ridiculous.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Welcome to Good Game, a podcast for crypto insiders with your host, Imran and Chow. All right, welcome to Good Game, episode 5. We took a week hiatus. We had a bunch of interesting meetings and events at ETH Bogota, DevCon. We had a team offsite, so we had a good time in Colombia. Otherwise, lots has happened over the past couple weeks. In fact, some of our listeners asked about macro. A lot has changed since, you know, over the past couple of weeks. So we'll definitely touch on that. We'll talk about this competition that's happening between both Coinbase and FTX, specifically Brian Armstrong and Sam. Both, you know, product company perspective, legal strategy, and essentially like mission, vision, goals, right? So there's a lot around what's happening there.
I feel like the legal battles are getting pretty heated. Like, I really feel like we're fighting the final boss now.
I feel that that's the same way. There's ultimately an easier strategy, and then there's more of a complex strategy. And I think what's wholesome for crypto is going through the complex strategy, and we'll talk through what that means. We'll touch on the DeFi super app thesis and then Cosmos V2. There's a lot of talks about Cosmos V2. But macro, a lot has shifted. Obviously, the markets have stalled a bit. A lot happening on the geopolitical side. So maybe what's top of mind for you, Chow? Yeah. And yeah.
I've been thinking about macro for a while. And just to be clear to our listeners, I don't do independent research, but I know who the right people to follow are. And I've done enough finance for the past 10 years to know that there's basically two criteria that you need to look at if you want to know who to follow in the macro space. One is that they're traders, not researchers. I think this is extremely important to know. Because, you know, researchers tend to not have enough skin in the game. You know, they tell you something, but their position might be completely different from what they say. I'm not saying that pure researchers are not helpful. Some of them can be really helpful, but relatively speaking, you want to allocate more weight to the traders. So the likes of Druckenmiller, like you and I,
yep,
watched his CNBC interview. The likes of Ray Dalio, Bob Prince. By the way, Ray Dalio recently retired or
yeah,
stepped down from the CIO position. But anecdotally, I've always known that Ray Dalio doesn't really do any investment over the past few years.
He's more he's like an influencer.
He's an influencer, exactly. It's really Bob Prince and his. They have three CIOs, and two of them do work. One of them is Bob Prince. The other one, I forgot his name. But those two, they've been on interviews a few times, and I really like what they how they think about macro. But yeah, so more weight on traders versus researchers. And the second criteria is you want to follow people who are historians, who study history, who are data-driven, who produce research that are actually statistically significant. And by the way, this happens a lot. The opposite of that happens a lot on crypto Twitter. Like people put out like some really interesting charts, but when you actually dig into it, like it's based on two data points. It's ridiculous.
I mean, there's not enough data in crypto to chart anything, really.
Yeah, that's right. There's been like four cycles, right?
Yeah.
Three or four cycles. But in macro, you can look at the past dozen of recessions, for example. And you can draw some pretty statistically significant conclusions from that. But anyway, so this is how my framework for analyzing macro is. I know the kind of people to follow. And here is my summary or synthesis of their views. I think Druckenmiller said a couple of weeks ago that he's very certain that by the end of 2023, we will have a hard landing. And the key word there is by the end of 2023. So it could happen anytime before. And there's a lot of people who think that it's going to happen sometime before. So it could be early next year, mid next year, or even Q4 this year.
And when we talk about hard landing, maybe just do a quick summary. The Fed has always argued that, you know, if we were to control the monetary fiscal policy based on where we are, we should be, quote unquote, we should hit like a soft landing so that the market wouldn't get impacted too much.
Yeah.
But you're arguing, or Druckenmiller is arguing, that there is going to be a hard landing. And what does that mean specifically?
All the smartest people I follow believe that the soft landing is bullshit.
So Fed Powell is not right?
Powell is never right. The Fed is a reactive function, not a proactive function.
Yeah.
And they might pivot when there is a hard landing, but they can't prevent that from happening. They can't engineer a soft landing if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But my gut instinct when I see that everyone is bearish is to be contrarian. Like everyone in the world is bearish right now. That is the problem. Like it is now the time to be contrarian.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a couple of data points. I wish I could show on the screen, but I have a couple of charts that show that basically right now, all the pros are bearish. They're hedged. They're in cash. They're short or whatever. But all the amateurs, basically the passive money and the households, are long. Okay. So there's this one chart from Bank of America Global Research that shows that US household equity flows is still positive. There's still inflow into passive funds or stock markets in general. Households are not bearish yet. Households haven't capitulated. And there's another chart from MacroCharts. It's a Twitter account, but it's a very interesting chart nevertheless, which shows that the flow into major US stock ETFs is still positive. There's still inflow, not outflow, despite the market going down. Whereas in 2008, during the Great Financial Crisis, there was massive amount of outflow. So passive strategies have not seen any capitulation either.
Why is that? Are people not, you hear it about in the media, people talk about it, that, you know, a recession's here or it's coming, rates are high, et cetera. I'm surprised that, you know, retail has not like reacted to that yet, or not as quickly as the pro traders. I'm just curious on what the disconnect is there.
I feel like the retail just don't know who to listen to. Like they listen to Jim Cramer and stuff like that. And practically they haven't felt the pain yet. They're probably starting to feel it because of the mortgage rates going up by like 2-3 fold, right? But they haven't reached that pain point where they have to really sell their stocks to pay their bills yet on average. So that's probably what's happening right now. But anyway, these two charts, I just found them interesting. They're not that statistically significant. They're just counterpoints to the narrative that everyone is bearish. Like everyone tells me that everyone's bearish, therefore it's time to be bullish. But the fact of the matter is, the pros are bearish and the retail and the passive strategies are not bearish yet. The more interesting chart that I want to talk to you about is a chart of the S&P plotted against the last 8 US recessions. Okay, so dating all the way back to 1970s. Interestingly, 6 of the last 8 recessions, the S&P bottomed during the second half of the recession. 1 of the last 8 recessions, the S&P bottomed in the first half of the recession. And the remaining 1 recession, the S&P bottomed after the recession. That one instance was actually the 2000 tech bubble. And the current market actually feels eerily similar to the 2000 tech bubble. So the point I'm trying to say here is right now we're not even talking about recession yet. We haven't even hit official recession, the NBER official recession.
Yep.
All the pundits, the media is thinking about when the recession will happen, not whether or not the recession is happening currently. So the recession hasn't hit yet. And if the past is statistically significant, then the bottom of the stock market will happen even further into the future, during the second half, if not later, during the recession.
We got a long ways to go.
Long ways to go. But I think, you know, if I synthesize the views of, you know, again, like the people that I like, that I trust, recession probably Q1, Q2, summer next year. That's like the average view of a handful of people that I can triangulate. And then the stock market might bottom during that period. It could bottom in Q4 or Q1 next year, or maybe Q2. We don't know yet. But the bottom, the capitulation hasn't happened in the stock market. And what does that mean for crypto? Well, you can argue that crypto is a leading market. You could argue that the crypto capitulation already happened a few months ago with the three arrows and, you know, Celsius, the Terra, those events. And matter of fact, in the last few weeks, you can see that crypto has held pretty well when the stock market has been going down 20, 20, 30%. So you could make an argument for that, but I wouldn't bet on crypto having bottomed already. So all in all, I think that in the coming months, we're very near a actually viable capitulation, liquidation event across all our risk markets, including crypto. That's the short-term macro stuff that I wanted to just give everyone an overview. That's my synthesis. But
lots to unpack.
Yeah. The more interesting thing I've been thinking about is more like the long-term stuff, like the long-term macro. That's really interesting to think about. Like, what's going to happen in the next 10 years? And what is the implication of that on crypto? Yesterday, I shared with you this article.
That was a great article. It was by Russell Napier.
Yeah, that was a great article.
Right? That was a very good article.
Yeah, Russell Napier. And it was, in fact, in line with my synthesis of other people's views so far as well, including you know, Paul Tudor Jones, Druckenmiller, Bob Prince, like, and some of the historians, market historians. So I think the view that I agree the most with is that the next decade will be a decade of secular inflation. That is the single most important point to remember.
And maybe give a quick summary on the Russell Napier article. Maybe I can talk a few points on it.
Yep.
So what Russell argues is the fact that fiscal monetary policy is going to completely move to governments versus central banks. And so you'll hear central banks have been much more hawkish, but they'll carry a very small stick in terms of what they can actually do. Governments will re-engineer base inflation. So traditionally, it's like 2% annual. It will now be re-rated to 4 to 6%. And what they want here is to grow GDP in a way that shows that there's still great economic activity happening, and therefore justifying the base rate change. With deglobalization, governments will reinvest into bringing more of the productions back to their own countries. And that should create a capital or CapEx increase for certain industries that are being brought back home or to different countries. What does that do for gold, Chao, and other like commodity assets?
If you look at the inflationary period of the 1970s, or even throughout history, gold never tracked inflation very well. And it's one of the things that people are, you know, the gold haters are talking about right now. Like, gold never really tracked inflation month to month. But over the course of a decade in the 1970s, gold did really well relative to inflation. And in fact, the strongest correlation is actually between gold and real interest rate. Real interest rate meaning the difference between the nominal interest rate and inflation. So the fact that gold does not track inflation very well in the short term might also be due to the nominal interest rate. But the point being, scarce assets like gold does track inflation or does perform really well against inflation over a long period of time. Hopefully, we see that with Bitcoin. Obviously, Bitcoin so far has acted more like a growth stock rather than a commodity, rather than like an inflation hedge. But the theory, if more and more people believe in that theory, by the way, Bitcoin is an extremely reflexive asset. The more people believe in the theory, the more Bitcoin will actually act that way. So more people believe in what, you know, Paul Tudor Jones said about, you know, Bitcoin potentially acting as a digital gold and inflation hedge, then it may actually behave that way in the coming decade. Again, you can't expect Bitcoin to track inflation month to month, but over the course of a decade, it could, in theory, do really well. But I want to summarize a little bit the factors that contribute to this core idea that the next decade will be a secular inflationary decade. Mm-hmm. There are basically two strong forces. The first force, by the way, is something that you mentioned earlier, which is that the government needs inflation to inflate away the debt. They have so much debt. Mm-hmm. Like at a back of the napkin calculation shows that like if the interest rate is kept at like 4 or 5%, then mm-hmm. the interest expense is on the same order of magnitude as military, healthcare, and social security, which is ridiculous. So they need inflation to inflate away the debt. There is almost no other way. The only other way is if you get a really big increase in productivity, but that's not something you can really hope for. You can't really engineer that. You can only hope that that will happen. The most proactive thing that the government can do is to inflate away the debt.
Sometimes I feel like we're talking about like Ponzi's.
the whole market is a Ponzi. But anyway, so that's the first mm-hmm. secular force. The other secular force is deglobalization. Mm-hmm. When you move the workforce back home, you're going to incur more costs because, you know, in a completely global free market, the products should be produced by cheap labor. All right, labor goes to where the lowest cost is. But if you forcibly move that labor back home, it's going to increase the cost of production and ultimately pass on the cost to consumers. And by deglobalization, I don't just mean like the US and China, you know, moving their workforce back home, but also actually wars, right, between like Ukraine and Russia. Like all these things are part of the same story, the global conflict story. But anyway, so these are the two strong forces. So then if you agree with the idea of a secular inflationary decade, by the way, you can argue against it, which is a humongous tech upgrade. Mm-hmm. A tech upgrade would be a deflationary force. But again, it's not something that we can really control. It's only something we can hope for.
Yeah.
And we still don't know if that deflationary force is as strong as those other two inflationary forces. I think that the smarter people, the people who are smarter than me on the macro side of things, they think that the inflationary forces are stronger than the deflationary force. So if you agree with this thesis, what does that mean to global markets, assets, including crypto? It turns out that, you know, every decade, you get a secular bull or bear market in in an asset class that is ultimately driven by these secular forces. So for example, in the 1990s, we had a huge tech bubble that was the defining market of the decade. In the 2000s, after the tech bubble, we had strong commodities, weak dollar, strong emerging markets, weak technology, weak growth stocks. In the 2010s, everything reversed. We had strong US equities, strong technology, strong growth stocks, strong dollar, weak emerging markets, weak commodities, weak value stocks. And it's likely that in the 2020s, everything reverses again. And what that means is strong commodities, that will almost happen by definition due to inflation, right? Inflation is the, like strong commodities is almost the definition of strong inflation. And as a result of strong commodities, we might get stronger emerging market stocks. And strong inflation also leads to weak tech, weak growth, at the expense of stronger value stocks.
So let's dive into the commodities piece. I think you and I were chatting yesterday about this. We could argue that, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum are classified as commodities, and they're both scarce in resources.
Yep.
Do you feel that Ethereum and Bitcoin could have its own kind of secular bull run? Whereas like growth tokens and just kind of the rest of the token markets will stagnate against Bitcoin and Ethereum?
My current mental model is in the next decade, we're actually going to see a long run decoupling between two categories of crypto, the commodity crypto and the growth crypto. And if the inflationary story is correct, proves to be correct, then the commodity crypto will do really well, will outperform the growth crypto. And commodity crypto basically means Bitcoin and possibly Ethereum, likely Ethereum, I would say. The problem with Ethereum is the supply is somewhat driven by the growth on Ethereum, right? The activity is happening on Ethereum. Mm-hmm. More activities means more fees.
Deflationary.
More ETH getting burned and ultimately more deflationary supply. So ETH is somewhat driven by growth, but it's also a commodity. And everything else is so early stage that I would consider them as quote-unquote growth crypto.
Everything is correlated, right? So if BTC ETH move, then pretty much the alts move alongside the majors. So, I mean, you could argue that, you know,
there's a difference between short-term correlation and long-term correlation. Like all the markets will be correlated in the short term, especially during those high volatility capitulation events.
Long-term.
But long-term, you can see a major decoupling between the two.
Okay. That's very interesting.
So I've talked about this with a few people in the past, and some people are a little bit confused by the notion that, like, they're not sure why inflation leads to weaker growth stocks or growth assets versus value assets, value stocks. So I'll try to explain it here. But the idea is that with higher inflation, you tend to get higher interest rate because the government wants to fight inflation with higher interest rate. But what happens with higher interest rate is that if you think of the value of a stock as the sum of future discounted cash flow, this is like corporate finance 101, then the cash flow that's further into the future gets discounted more. Mm-hmm. The higher the interest rate goes, the more discount factor is applied to future cash flows. And by definition, growth stocks have more cash flow into the in further into the future rather than in the near future, right? Like that's like the definition of growth. Like they're not profitable now, but hopefully they will be profitable in 5 to 10 years. That's why they are disproportionately affected, negatively affected by higher interest rate and ultimately higher inflation. Whether or not this translates into crypto, like the growth crypto assets, is debatable because crypto assets don't have cash flow. Like the vast majority of them don't really have any cash flow. And even if they wanted to, like there's all sorts of impediments from like the securities laws and all that stuff. So it's debatable. However, if people generally get into this mindset that, you know, the long tail of crypto assets are growth, which intuitively makes sense, then it's possible that the growth crypto assets will behave similarly to growth stocks in the next 10 years. So anyway, this is my current mental model. It's not a super strong thesis yet, but that's how I view things at the moment. This dichotomy between commodity crypto and growth crypto is something to watch for.
And I mean, I feel like for at least growth crypto, there still is so much work that needs to be done in order for us to get mass adoption, right? I mean, you know, we have, I don't know, I've mentioned this before, probably like 10, 11 million monthly active users. They're using MetaMask. And I'd say, you know, maybe 50%, 75% of that, maybe 50% are using DeFi. I'm just throwing out a number.
Yep.
I don't even think it's that much. I think it's just a million users less. So at least with like traditional growth startups and companies, they have users, they have real product, they have revenue. DeFi and like crypto generally aren't nowhere near where traditional companies are right now, is the way I see it. So what you're saying is if the narrative holds true, then I think crypto growth assets will get affected much more.
Yep. And the commodity crypto will actually benefit from inflation and ultimately negative real interest rate, similarly to gold.
You know, lots of data there to unpack, but I think pretty much for those that are seeing the, you know, kind of the global macros change, we are pivoting to a completely new era, and we need to be, you know, prepared and just understand, you know, the types of landscapes that we're going to be operating in. The markets, the way they worked before, aren't going to work the way they are moving forward.
Yeah. People are used to sort of 30 years of globalization, increasing globalization. The 2010s were actually the peak of globalization. 30 years of that, and then 10, 20 years of extreme monetary experiments in monetary policies. And more recently, extreme experiments in fiscal policies post-COVID. The fiscal policies may not change. In fact, might get even worse in the next 10 years. But the other two multi-decade megatrends are definitely reversing.
Exciting times. And so I guess, what does that mean for crypto and like all the great things that are happening there? It's yet to be seen. But, you know, over the past couple of weeks, you started to hear a lot about the narratives between like FTX and Coinbase. Mm-hmm. And you see Brian Armstrong being compared to Sam Bankman-Fried from FTX. And it's pretty interesting to see that crypto Twitter battled this out. There's a camp that's like pro Brian and there's a camp that's pro Sam. And both camps are pretty aggressive against the other. It's polarizing, but it's also interesting to see. And for me, it was just like understanding, what is it about these two that people care so much about? Why FTX and Coinbase? Why do they care about these companies so much? Mm-hmm. I did some analysis and there's some interesting data points that I'll share with you. And then maybe we can discuss like our thoughts. But before I get started, anything you want to add to that?
I'm starting to, I use Twitter less and less these days. It's a little bit boring, but I do start to realize or notice this, this cult or difference in cults behind the Coinbase cult and the FTX cult. They're mostly not based on facts. So I really want to get into the bottom of this, like see what's really happening behind the scenes.
Yeah. And it's fundamentally a lot to do with their backgrounds. You and I chatted about this last week or the last podcast, which is like the layer one founders. A lot has to do with who they are, what experiences they have and what they've done in the past and how are they bringing it into crypto and layer ones. In fact, that's true with every founder in the space. And I found that to be true with both Brian Armstrong and Sam Bankman-Fried. So I'll give you a quick background on Coinbase. It turns out, so Brian Armstrong started Coinbase during his night and weekends while he was at Airbnb. This was around 2012. He spent probably 20 hours a week working on his side. And he finally got it to a point where there was an MVP. He applied to Y Combinator and then eventually got accepted. So he didn't get accepted on his first try. It took him a few tries to get in.
What was it? Was it Garrett Chen who admitted him?
It was Paul Graham.
Oh, it was Paul Graham. Interesting.
Paul Graham. It was Paul Graham. And I'm sure Gary Tan was a part of the diligence process. And so it was probably both Gary Tan and Paul Graham. But I know that Gary Tan was the first check-in outside of YCOM. So,
and then one of the few check-ins, I remember that story, like no one wanted to invest in Coinbase because what the hell is this Bitcoin thing?
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting because a lot of this data comes from both watching the documentary, and then I did a lot of research on all of his interviews and read a lot of articles and stuff like that. So So he finally got accepted. He got a seed check for $150,000, and he quit his job at Airbnb, and he started a prototype. So he finished the program, and after the program, he went to demo day. And no one invested. Everyone passed. Or for the most part, he said most people passed on him.
Yeah.
he didn't have a co-founder. No one really cared about a hosted Bitcoin wallet because that was his first product. It wasn't the ability to buy Bitcoin. It was just the ability to host a cloud-based wallet similar to like an email client, mm-hmm. like Gmail. That was his kind of like original thesis. Then there's some interesting data points that I want to highlight. One is he moved to Argentina. He moved there for a year before going to Y Combinator. I want to touch on this. And he realized how bad inflation was over there. He said that he would be at a place eating lunch and they would change the menu in front of him, the prices, because the prices changed. And he realized how bad that was, right? Mm-hmm. And one day he went back home during Christmas to his house and he read the Bitcoin white paper and realized that this is going to change everything. And that's how he actually said, like when he was flying back to Venezuela, he said, why am I even flying back to Venezuela? I'm going to fly back and like work on this idea. And that's kind of how he came up with the idea. Then he applied to Y Combinator, then got out. He needed to find a co-founder. He found Fred on Reddit. And they kind of got together and they built out Coinbase to where it's at now. Mm-hmm. So that's the founding story. Some other interesting facts. His parents are both engineers. His dad is an environmental engineer and his mom is an engineer at IBM. And this will dictate a lot of things that I'm going to be talking about in the future here. And so that's like Brian's background. Sam's background, it's a little bit different. So his background is, you know, both his parents were lawyers, professors at Stanford. So you have, you know, Brian's backgrounds who are engineers. Then you have Sam's parents who are both professors, legal professors. He had a very early interest in games. So he loved like StarCraft, went to MIT. He went there for physics, wanted to become a physics professor. Then he learned about effective altruism. And if you know what effective altruism is to make as much money as possible so that you can give it away systematically. And he realized that he couldn't make a lot of money being a professor. And so that's how he got into trading. And so he worked at Jane Street for 3.5 years. And he heard about Bitcoin a few times. He didn't care for it much. He didn't care. Decentralization, openness didn't really pull him. What pulled him into crypto was the inefficiency in the markets. The price arbitrage between the US markets and like other like nascent markets. Right? Buy Bitcoin in the US, sell it into emerging countries. And he thought that was very interesting. So he ended up starting Alameda and he started to kind of like start arbitrage trading and started to scale up. I think in a year he was trading roughly $25 million a day in trading volume, just him and his one or two other people. And I'd say probably a year after Alameda, he realized like Robinhood, Fidelity, and even Coinbase didn't cater to high HFTs, right? So he started FTX. He started in May 2019, which was like at the bottom of the bear, raised like, I don't know, $8 million.
I think Coinbase tried to do that in 20... It was the last bear market. They started... Remember they launched the Chicago office and then they shut it down like a year later?
Yes.
So they tried to do that. Like the reason why they opened an office in Chicago was to get the high frequency traders and, you know, the people who work at, you know, CME and all those people. But it didn't work out. I don't know why. They never really believed in it.
I think a lot has to do with their backgrounds, right? You have, you know, an engineer versus a trader. Yep. And his thesis behind FTX was, you know, he wants to incorporate both buyer, seller and clearinghouse all in one. And, you know, just kind of be the most competitive brand in the space. Yeah. And so that's his background. So
I mean, it's no coincidence that FTX is the best exchange for pro traders. Like I remember the one-liner of FTX, at least, you know, a couple years ago was exchange by traders for traders. Like FTX is built by traders, so they know how their customers think.
100%. And so, I mean, all of this is very interesting to me, and I'll tell you why. One is Brian was impacted by like what happened in Venezuela, right? He saw inflation. He saw that, you know, he is a builder. He grew up in Silicon Valley, and he understood that, like, you know, he wants to build a product that the world can use. And his mission statement is to increase economic freedom. Like, that is Coinbase's fundamental thesis. And FTX's fundamental thesis is effective altruism. So, you know, it's to make as much money as possible, to give away as much money as possible. He wants to increase net happiness in the world based on one of his interviews. And I think all of that drives product. It drives their strategy, their legal strategy. And it also drives how they think about monetization in the long run.
Yeah. You showed me a screenshot of the FTX website and the Coinbase website the other day for their product. Yeah. Do you want to talk about it?
Yeah. So if you go on both of their websites, you could tell right off the cuff that their product strategies are very, very different. Although there is some overlap, and that overlap is institutions. If you look at Coinbase, it's very like crypto-centric, right? So Coinbase Cloud, what is Coinbase Cloud? Well, it's tools and infrastructure that allows anyone to build Web3 apps, right? You could get, you know, Node as a service, you can get NFT APIs, you can get staking, payments, identity, trading, they offer compliance products, a whole host of like crypto apps that allows any founder in the space to build great apps.
And there's semi-custodial wallet, which allows users to directly access DeFi or on-chain apps without sacrificing the security. Like, it just feels like all their product lines are designed from a crypto native perspective.
Yep.
And anecdotally, we heard this from their employees like a couple of years ago that there were a couple of employees that were looking to leave Coinbase and told us that Brian Armstrong was making a very massive internal change when it comes to their crypto nativeness. Like, Brian Armstrong wants to go fully crypto native. Back then, the employee composition of Coinbase was like 95% non-native.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted to change that. Like, I feel like 2 years ago was when they really saw the opportunity in the expansion of crypto native apps. I'm sure it's always been their vision, but that was like the best timing for them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, if you want to differentiate from your competitors, right, you know, you have to pick some DNA that will align with your mission, vision, and then also the founder, right?
Yeah.
And that's why, like, digging into the history makes a lot of sense, because it kind of gives you a way to chart how they're thinking about their competitive landscape. And then ultimately, how is it going to influence the legal strategy as well? So that's the high level on, like, some of what Coinbase is offering in terms of product. I mean, lots of different, like, Web3 products. And they do have an institution focus, Coinbase Pro. And just stats on Coinbase Pro, it's a institutional exchange based on spun out of Coinbase. I think it's done like $1.3 billion in volume as of date. And that's kind of where Coinbase is at. And in general, like, Coinbase as a company, they've generated $7.8 billion in revenue in 2021. Probably $3 billion net income, has about 103 million users, 4,900 employees, and probably mostly focused on retail, although their institutional trading volume has eclipsed retail, but a lot of retail users still using it. Whereas with FTX, their mission is effective altruism. And so 2/3 of their volume comes from institutions. Their core focus in terms of product is like derivatives, options, advanced trading, OTC. They do offer some white label solutions for like fiat on-ramps and off-ramps, but primarily like hyper-focus on the trading side. FTX has done like $5.7 billion in total trading volume compared to Coinbase Pro's $1.3 billion in trading volume. So you could kind of tell like where the institutions sit and then where do retail sit. And so FTX generated $1 billion revenue in 2021. About that, $388 million is net income, 1.2 million users, about 300 employees. So a smaller team, you know, revenue is not close to what Coinbase is doing, but their growth trajectory is pretty strong in terms of just the company backgrounds.
How do these product lines inform their legal strategies?
Yeah, this is a fun one because one is hyper-focused on creating open economic freedom for the rest of the world, which means that you have to create new regulations, legal frameworks in order for you to allow these products to coexist with the world that we live in today. And then you have a trading product like, you know, that's hyper-focused on institutions that want to make it easy as fast as possible for people with large size to trade crypto. And so those are like two fundamentally two different visions. And so we'll go through some of their kind of like advocacy and, you know, legislation and motivations just to get an understanding of like, how are they both thinking about it? Mm-hmm. In terms of like advocacy, FTX has been hyper-focused on, you know, they're focused on the relationship with CFTC and the role of the Senate Agriculture Committee. And this primarily means that they see a world where the CFTC has oversight on crypto. Whereas Coinbase, they've been pretty vocal. So they have their own PAC. They have a partnership with crypto rating councils. They had filed a lawsuit with Tornado Cash with the litigation that happened recently. So they were very public about that. They oppose the characterization of tokens trading on exchanges as securities. They call for individuals to advocate for crypto policy, has more of an adversarial relationship with the SEC, and then obviously heavily opposed amendments to tax regulations within the infrastructure bill. So one is more geared towards like CFTC and giving them the oversight, whereas Coinbase is playing like a different role within the different government institutions.
Coinbase was also fighting the IRS a few years ago for to protect the privacy of their customers' information. Although like they still had to leak some information to the IRS, but at least they claimed that they've done everything they could.
Yeah, I think it was 13,000 users that were given up. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I was one of them.
Oh, were you? That sucks. I guess like more recently, and the reason why this is all coming up is because Richard Chen from One Confirmation tweeted out that Sam Bankman-Fried is a strong proponent of the DCCPA, which is called the Digital Commodities Consumer Protection Act. And we can talk through what this bill is, like what it does, and then maybe talk about the both views and what it means for us in crypto generally. The DCCPA is a proposed bill that gives CFTC new powers to register spot markets. It forces human intermediation, right? So there has to be some sort of central authority behind, you know, protocols. Like if we were to talk about DeFi specifically, where they would have to have some centralized infrastructure as well with people that are running it. They're often conversing and have an open dialogue with the CFTC. And it heavily favors incumbents and kills startups.
My takeaway of that bill from like after the legal analysis that our legal team has done internally is that basically that bill treats DeFi projects as intermediaries rather than disintermediaries. In other
That's
words,
right.
They need to have like their own chief compliance officer. They need to do a lot of like human work and communication mm-hmm. with their regulators instead of just, you know, a piece of code that runs on its own. Obviously, you're always going to have developers that upgrade the code, etc. But, you know, but that bill does introduce a lot of compliance burden. But the most fucked up part about that bill is that the moment you introduce those, you know, centralized human components, the DeFi project is fundamentally at odds with the SEC.
Yep.
Because if you launch a token and you're centralized, you are going to be treated as a security by the SEC. At least at the moment, that's how the SEC thinks about it. So the combination of that bill and the SEC stance towards securities puts all the DeFi projects into an impossible conundrum, right? Like, do you comply with CFTC or do you comply with SEC? Like, it's an impossible problem to solve. It's so ridiculous.
It's fucked up.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to think about like innovation and how do we keep
talented folks with high growth startups in the US as an example, well, you have to have some like uniformity across agencies, right? Government agencies. Otherwise, they're just going to leave. And in fact, people are leaving. They're not staying in the US because of this.
Yeah.
But you know, you brought up some good points, right? The question then becomes, well, one, kudos to Dane Lund and Mike W. from our legal team that's been working hard on this. They've been working day and night and working with regulators and making sure that we continue to stay focused on making sure that founder has freedom to do what they want and what to build. Because this is there's a lot of background work that goes to this. So that's the DCCPA bill act. And so what's Sam's stance and what is Brian's stance and what are they doing about it?
Yeah.
Sam is a huge proponent of the DCCPA. He even offered to help underwrite a possible CFTC exchange registration program. He believes that some tokens are digital commodities, but most are securities. Wants exchanges regulated by CFTC, wants to permit exchanges to offer leverage directly rather than through brokers. And so that's the high level from
Sam's
FTX.
Sam's support of that bill, do we know for sure, or is it a rumor, or is it a
no? It's for sure.
Okay.
It's a fact. But there are a lot of misinformation on Twitter that talks about like you know Sam, you know this is the reason why Sam wants to do this, and it's like bad for DeFi and crypto, and we don't know that, right? We don't know his intentions. So I am not gonna. We're not going to dive into like his intentions because we don't know what his intentions are. For all we know, it could be for good.
I mean, we have some opinions about it, but we don't know the facts. So we can't really comment on it.
We can't. And I think Kyle Samani tweeted out that everyone is thinking wrongly about Sam's tweets and that having CFTC oversight over SEC oversight is actually better for crypto. There's more leeway in regards to how these crypto assets could be regulated, traded, and implemented.
My problem with that view in particular, the oversight view, whether or not it's good for crypto, I don't have a strong opinion. I can see arguments both ways. But the single biggest problem right now is there's no clarity. And that's
no clarity.
What puts founders in a really difficult position. There's no fucking clarity. Yeah. Like they're trying to interpret laws from 100 years ago. And we don't know which tokens under what exact criteria should be classified as securities versus commodities. And until Congress comes out with new laws, we can only make some educated guess and take some really conservative stance, like from a founder's perspective. If they want to get into trouble, they need to stay on the conservative side, which, by the way, stifles innovation.
Yep.
They definitely don't want to ultimately go to the court and fight the regulators because it's going to kill them. It's going to be too long and too expensive of a process.
Yeah,
that is the problem right now. The lack of clarity is the real problem.
We've been going through this for the past, you know, whatever decade, right? It's so fucked up, and so some founders are going to continue building. They're not going to let go of an opportunity, right? Similar to like Uber, right? When Uber first launched, when they had a lot of hits on the regulatory side, but they kept building. And so that's something that we work with our founders on within the Alliance is like your regulatory strategy, making sure that you have your defenses up and making sure that any loopholes could be mitigated. Coinbase's strategy is that they support DCCPA, but with some changes. Changes include like provisions that permits exchanges to self-certify that tokens are commodities and gives the CFTC the opportunity, but not the obligation to object, which I think makes a lot of sense, right? Like allowing the exchanges to make the call over CFTC because CFTC really has no fucking clue what's going on, right? So that's one. The other is like they like highly praise the Lummis-Gillibrand bill, which creates clear regime for Web3 projects to create commodity tokens, so more helpful for like Coinbase to substantiate listings with regards to SEC, et cetera. So that's about like the Coinbase's strategy in terms of legal. But if you look at it, like if you look at both strategies, one strategy is focused on institutions, the other is focused on Web3 founders. That's the way I perceive it as. Yeah, I don't know. What do you think about that?
My characterization is one is focused on crypto native and the other one is focused on trading crypto as an asset.
And they're both very clear in regards to their focus. But yeah, so interesting analysis. It was fun to read on how that DNA got started and why it's there's so much influence within the company and their legal strategy.
Yeah.
Very unbiased view. So the other pretty interesting announcement that came out a couple weeks ago is Cosmos V2. A lot of chatter about it.
Yeah.
You and I, I think in our first podcast, talked about the DeFi super app thesis, if you remember that.
Mm-hmm. The wallet super app thesis.
The wallet super app thesis. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of overlap to that. And maybe we could talk a bit about, you know, the V2 and what it means for everyone. Do you want to highlight anything on the V2 side that you saw that was interesting?
Maybe you can give us some context first, like quick summary, and then maybe we can dive into some of the specifics.
Yeah. So Cosmos V2, what I thought was very cool was when you read the V2 white paper, it starts out with the confirmation that the vision set out back in 2016 has been realized. You know, you don't read that often in crypto. Like most of the time, the project's rug and they take your shit and leave. But we didn't get rugged this time. So yeah. I thought that was very powerful.
And in many other cases, like in the case of Ethereum, they pivoted so many times.
They did, yeah.
Like the I remember the original white paper or yellow paper of Ethereum back in 2014. They said they were going to launch sharding like by the end of 2016 or 2017 or something like that.
Oh, the sharding.
It's been like 10 years. And they've pivoted many times in between.
So, you know, if you look at Atom, like over the course of the past, like, I don't know, 2018, was it when they launched? Cosmos was just really a meme coin, right? There wasn't much value that accrued to Cosmos. The only reason why you would buy Cosmos or Atom was to stake and earn tokens, right? That was it. And there wasn't like a meme. And, you know, if you looked at Atom's market cap relative to others, it was like, you know, 1/10, right?
Yeah. What's even more a little bit outrageous is that the price of Atom or market cap of Atom was lower than well below that of Terra, and Terra is is built on the Cosmos SDK and all that stuff.
Terra FDV was 2x bigger than Atom at one point. That's insane. But it kind of gives you, I feel like there's some foreshadowing there that I want to touch on later. So, you know, Cosmos SDK circumvented Cosmos Hub, thus not allowing it to capture any value, right? Because the SDK offers seamless integrations. There wasn't a way to charge transactions or fees. And so people were able to use Tendermint and IBC and Cosmos SDK quite easily. The goal now is to find a way where the Cosmos Hub accrues value. That's like the primary goal.
The Atom token.
The Atom token specifically. Yep. And so there are some plans in place. If you read their white paper, you'll see like the new stack that they've built. The Cosmos stack, which is the original stack, included like Tendermint, which is the consensus mechanism, IBC, inter-blockchain connections, I believe, which allows other communications, thank you, that allows different zones to talk to each other. And then the Cosmos SDK, which includes like CosmWasm, which is their smart contract. And so that was the original thesis for Cosmos V1. Cosmos V2 offers two additional layers on top. The first layer is called the secure economic scaling, which means there's two buckets, right? There's interchain security, and then there's liquid staking. So what is interchain security? Well, the biggest problem with Cosmos previously was the inability to spin up zones quickly with validators, right? Like you have to create your own zone and then you have to recruit your own validators.
That was by far the number one obstacle for builders wanting to launch a new Cosmos zone. It's the same story with Polkadot. And in fact, it's even worse for Polkadot because in the case of Polkadot, you also need to own a shit ton of DOT token in order to participate in the parachain auction. So in both cases, it's a huge impediment.
Huge impediment. So now the ability to for a zone to spin up quickly and recruit new validators that are validating on Cosmos Hub is a much, much easier. You could call this kind of like a validation as a service model, mm-hmm. where you could recruit validators easily, spin up your own zone, and then you ultimately control the sovereignty of the chain. Mm-hmm. So that was like one interesting layer on top of the Cosmos stack.
And the way it works, I learned about it this morning, is that the Cosmos Hub validators who also own the Atom token are eligible to provide the share security to other zones. And so other zones have the option to like negotiate the, you know, how much reward they want to give to these validators. It could be in the form of their native tokens or whatever. But in other case, it seems like it's going to be market driven rather than like some set parameter. But something we need to confirm with, like, you know, one day we should probably bring on Jack or Zaki on our show and talk to them about. But my high level perception of the Cosmos 2.0 vision is, like, you know, the vision is very clear, but a lot of the parameters still a bit up in the air, which, by the way, is completely normal. Like, they need to work on all these details.
Yeah. Me, after reading the white paper, it's the plan sounds quite optimistic. And so, like, seeing it in production, I'd like to see how this is going to get all implemented. Yeah. A lot of structural changes.
So interchain security or the share security, what else is there?
Liquid staking. Traditionally, you had, you know, liquid staking companies like Stride or P-Stake and others that offer their own, like, similar to Lido, right? So, like, you will go in and then you'll stake your Atom tokens and you'll receive some sort of derivative of that token. And the problem with that is, you know, there's so many different markets, marketplaces that have their own liquidity fragmentation, and I feel like over time, it's just going to get concentrated to a few players in the space. But there wasn't a way to do this permissionlessly, right? So you have to, as a user, go through the entire steps to do this. With the new V2, it's already built into the Cosmos SDK with third-party vendors. And all a person has to do is stake their tokens with the validator. They would receive a liquid staking module token, which would then be deposited to, like, Stride Labs, and they would receive ST Atom. And so it works all permissionlessly, and validators don't have to directly work with the staking derivative platforms. It all happens permissionlessly through the SDK. Mm-hmm. And so those are two like economic scaling models. And then on top of that, you have two more, which is the interchain scheduler and the interchain allocator. The interchain scheduler is essentially a way to gain more fees within the Cosmos ecosystem. So the way you want to think about this is, like, you could pay a fee to front run a transaction within all of the zones that are out there. The best example I can give you is the new interchain scheduler allows people to pay a fee to front run a transaction. They're essentially bribes that lead to more transparency, and the protocol can collect fees. What it does is it uses Tendermint to separate transaction ordering from validation. The scheduler then captures the MEV revenue from auctioning transaction ordering rights within a zone. And then the validators end up getting some of the fees accrued, and then some of the fees go to the Cosmos Hub. The other is essentially cross-chain MEV marketplace. So the way this works is, so let's say that, you know, you have two different zones that have two different liquidity pools. So let's say ETH-USDC in one, like, zone, and then the other zone you may have, like, USDC and X. And the cool thing about this is that, you know, you could run this arbitrage trade that would ultimately execute, bundle all of your transaction into, like, one transaction, and then execute the trade where you can essentially buy ETH and sell it into a different zone's pool. And the MEV behind that would then go to some to the validator, and then some to the zone or to the hub. Mm-hmm. And so you could think of this as a marketplace for all the blocks of Cosmos chains, and you get to order transactions in a way that would ultimately allow the person to arbitrage between different zones instantaneously is the best way to explain it. Mm-hmm. I hope I explained that right.
Yeah. No, it was good.
Yeah. The last one is just an ecosystem fund. It's called the interchain allocator, but I call it just an ecosystem fund, which is, like, once V2 is launched, the issuance, there's an increased amount of issuance that goes to this interchain allocator. Then over time, issuance drops dramatically. But essentially, this interchain allocator will have liquidity, and it could be used as a way to bootstrap liquidity on different zones when they launch.
I mean, my takeaway...
Invest in startups.
My takeaway is, like, all these four different things are designed to accrue value to the Atom token. Like every single one of them, is a way to make Atom more valuable. And obviously, the interchain security, the share security, solves a really big pain point for new builders, not having to recruit their own validators. So, like with that, we might see a huge explosion of new Cosmos zones.
Yeah. We'll see a lot of zones, and there will be a lot of liquidity. You know, like for anyone to, I think the biggest problem for zones, I believe, outside of just the validator service model where you can recruit validators, is liquidity fragmentation, right? Because you don't, like, the thing about like monolithic chains is that, you know, you have liquidity that you can always source from, right? You just need to offer the right integrations, incentives as a way to pull that liquidity to you. But in Cosmos and with the different zones, you know, liquidity is fragmented into these zones, right? So like Osmosis has, you know, X amount of, like, I don't know, billions in liquidity. And the only way you could transfer this liquidity to other chains, to other zones, is through IBC. And even that process is very convoluted. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. So the way I see this happening is with the interchain allocator, this like liquidity pool of money could be used as a way to bootstrap liquidity in different zones. And if all goes well and they launch the product right and they have, you know, X amount of liquidity already allocated to the zone, then I could see some interesting developments happening over time. But the way the Atom or the Cosmos and the Hub ecosystem is design, it's designed to concentrate power into one zone or to individual zones versus the entire ecosystem is the way that I see it.
Yeah.
Play out.
I mean, overall, I just got far more bullish than I used to be on Cosmos. The combination of their focus on creating an actual value accrual mechanism to the Atom token, and the fact that there is more and more organic missionary developers building on top of Cosmos. Atom is definitely something I want to buy in the bear market. And if you look at the chart, Atom is barely up from like the last bear market. Like it hasn't moved. Like it's been like 5 years. Whereas everything else has gone up like 10x. Like Ethereum is up, like it's up 10x, one order of magnitude. Atom barely moved. I don't know. I want to own Atom when the capitulation event actually happens.
Yeah, I'm looking at the chart too. Holy, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is insane. So I do see a very bright future for Cosmos and Atom.
Yeah.
Especially with the validation that DYDX moved over to Cosmos, shows that, like, you know, there is a strategy for those that are building monolithic chains, that value accrual or value leakage is actually very important for the app itself, right?
Yeah.
Not having to compete with others for like block space, as an example, being able to accrue more of the value and using that value to secure your own chain is probably the right model when you have maybe X amount of users, right? But starting off, like building on Ethereum makes a lot of sense. Just the ease of cost, being able to pull composability, synchronous composability from others, and just building a brand for yourself. But the end goal, I think, is to ultimately own the customer relationship.
By the way, this idea crossed my mind recently that the Cosmos vision and the Ethereum vision are actually converging. Like if you think about what's happening on the rollups on Ethereum, I think there is more and more specialization, like with Arbitrum launching specific chains for each type, for each vertical. But more interestingly, in the future, probably some kind of app-specific rollup, right? I mean, DYDX has tried this in the past. And now that Cosmos is doing interchain or share security, like the two visions are almost the same now. Like you have Cosmos where people launch app chains and using the Cosmos Hub for share security, and then you have Ethereum where people launch app-specific rollups and using the Ethereum mainnet for share security, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting convergence of vision, in my opinion. And earlier this week, we had Anatoly speak or present to our founders on Monday. And if you've seen what Anatoly has said on Twitter, he's not a believer in rollups. But he did caveat that this Monday, earlier this week, to our founders that he does think that app-specific rollups could make sense on Solana. So even Solana might move into that direction. And by the way, all the rollup stuff is permissionless. Like, even if the Solana core devs don't believe in it, it can still happen, right?
Yeah, well, like even with rollups, you could switch the computation to like a C-level VM, right? And that's obviously very positive. That's like positive for the Solana ecosystem, and they probably want more of that.
Yeah.
And so I could see this world where many monolithic chains will start to introduce their own types of rollups as a way to create that app specific exponential growth support. Right. So like, you know, if you think computation and block space is elastic and that everyone's going to be competing for the same space, then it may make sense for these apps that bring in tremendous amount of traction and volume to start to think about their own like rollup as a way to scale and continue to earn security from the monolithic chain. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about a lot, macro, Coinbase versus FTX, or specifically Sam and Brian, and finally Cosmos V2. We have a lot more to talk about, and I think we can do that in our next session.
Yeah, I really wanted to talk about the token stuff, because like we had a couple of DeFi OGs, really the who's who of DeFi, present earlier this week to our founders, and their takeaway on tokens, I felt it was spot on, and I really wanted to share that with our audience soon.
And also also touching on like the super app thesis and where it's heading also, because we had some early talks about that in our first episode. And so we'll leave that for our next episode. Again, thanks for tuning in. Hit subscribe if you haven't already, and we'll see you guys soon.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to Good Game. Don't forget to subscribe. We'll see you next week.